Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Fewer immigrants are choosing to make Michigan their new home, but there is one group who's continuing to come, and come in droves, Iraqis. On today's show, we explore why and what it means for our state. Then we look at the possibility of Detroit emergency manager Kevin Orr using artwork at the Detroit Institute of Arts as collateral for a city loan. But first, Governor Rick Snyder has tapped a veteran auto industry executive to become the state's automotive advisor. Governor Snyder announced the appointment of Nigel Francis, and he created the Automotive Industry Office earlier this week. The new position and the new office will be housed within the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. Nigel Francis has almost 30 years of executive experience in the auto sector, both in Europe and the U.S. Most recently, he worked for Tata Technologies in Novi and Troy. Nigel Francis joins us now. Welcome to Stateside.
Cindy, thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here, and what a wonderful day in Michigan it is here today. Thank you very much.
It truly is. Nigel, help us to understand. We hear the announcement of your new job, but explain to us what you'll be doing.
Well, certainly. There's effectively two roles. One role is to work within the MEDC and leverage the MEDC resources, which are fantastic, together with all of the extended economic development agencies and resources throughout the state to develop more and better business in the state of Michigan in the automotive sector. The second part of the role is to act as an advisor to the governor and his team in relation to automotive matters. Sounds very grandiose, but if you actually cut right the way through it, it's a large-scale business development job for the state of Michigan in the automotive sector.
So are there benchmarks that you're in the process of setting for yourself or for the Snyder administration or really for the Michigan auto industry where there'll be a time when you will know that what you're doing is actually working in your eyes?
Yeah, very good question. As you, I guess you realize, I'm an engineer by education, and I spent most of my life in product development, actually, in the automotive industry. And what's important there, what comes from that experience is that you have a process. And put into simple terms, the process that I'm used to is listen and learn, develop a plan, market test the plan, seamlessly execute, measure, and feedback and improve. So not surprisingly, here on day three, I'm talking to lots of people and have already started reaching out. And indeed, many people in the state of Michigan have been reaching back to me so that we can together consult and together maintain the state world-leading position in the automotive sector and grow it and continue to grow it in a sustainable fashion over many, many years going forward.
You know, one of the situations that we have lived through over the decades in Michigan is this boom or bust cycle of the auto industry. Do you think that's something that we might be able to control better so we don't have these deep, deep recessions and then, just like we're seeing now in the industry, these big booms?
Very interesting question, and I'd love to have been educated as a global economist to answer that accurately. Let me give you a simple engineer's answer to that. I think that many things in life are cyclical. Obviously, global economies, regional economies, countries' economies are cyclical by definition. And the automotive industry is so embedded into the life of individual people through the products and into the economies that by definition has to be cyclical, I believe. Of course, the challenge is to try to fill in the troughs and indeed to be able to react to the peaks. And I see one way of helping to fill in the troughs is I would like to see, but of course this needs to be tested with the many people that can give me advice as well, I'd like to see more emphasis on fundamental technologies and then the application of those fundamental technologies, particularly as we're living, in my opinion, in a time where the motor car is changing. It's becoming much more electronics driven. Could become very close to a moving computer, using the industry speak. connected vehicle is becoming very important. So the auto industry is a highly complex and highly competitive industry, as you know.
Yes. In terms of your goal, one of your goals of bringing new jobs to Michigan, what do you think needs to happen to increase Michigan's share of the global automotive business?
Well, I think fundamentally what my flag is that I wish to fly is that we are the global leader in Michigan in the automotive industry, in my opinion. We need to maintain that position. And the very best way of maintaining that position is if we work together as a team. So part of my outreach to the community is absolutely going to be to encourage collaborative efforts and to encourage people to be thankful for the position that the state and the industry has managed to work hard to create for itself over the last roughly 100 years, and look forward together with the extended enterprise, all of the stakeholders, to create the next 100 years. It's not about just tomorrow. Tomorrow is important because it's there, but the measure of great success for me would be if we are able together to work out how we maintain and sustainably grow the position of Michigan in the automotive industry over the next many tens of years, 100 years, yes, but 100 years is a long time for people to think about. 20 or 30 year time frame for sure.
So how do you do that?
Well, I think it comes back to positioning the products and the enabling technologies that need to go into those products such that we continue to have within an hour's drive of Troy, for example, Troy, Michigan, an hour's drive, everything that you need to produce a world-class product on a rolling forward basis. So there's a huge need to keep abreast of evolving technologies, and those technologies themselves need a highly talented workforce, and that workforce itself needs to continue to reinvent itself in terms of its skill set to keep up with the technologies.
Nigel, do you see a gap in the education process in terms of meeting the technical demands of auto jobs? Is there too much emphasis on that four-year degree and perhaps not enough on the technical training to meet those job needs?
Another good question, which happens to be very close to my heart. So, yes, I think that a successful automotive industry needs a whole array of skills. Now, there's very, very good programs out there. I would love to, and I wish to sit down with the leaders in academia in the state and actually just work through. In my opinion, we need a range of academic qualifications that go from highly theoretically based through a mixture of hands-on practical with theoretical base through to the highly technically hands-on oriented people. And it will be wonderful to have a very seamless system that enables an individual person to move about in that throughout their career. So they might start, for example, as a hands-on technical person and find later in life that they're actually inclined to be a more theoretical person, or vice versa indeed, you know.
So it sounds like Michigan's not there yet. That's something to aim towards.
I think that we have world-class universities in the state which produce excellent products, the products being people. I think that, however, what I think is that the automotive industry moves very quickly and continues to move quickly, and we need to be ready with the right talent at the right time. And I need to be educated to find out whether or not we are going to be ready with the right talent at the right time.
Nigel Francis, as you look toward the future, because you're very, very clear that what you want to be doing is going to be paying off decades down the road, give us a sense, where do you see the auto industry in Michigan, let's say in 10 years? What will it look like?
I would hope and will work hard to ensure that it is stronger than it is today, and bigger than it is today, and that the jobs that are associated with that are well-paid, interesting, fun jobs for the people of Michigan.
Michigan's new automotive advisor, Nigel Francis, he will head up the newly created automotive industry office. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Cindy, and I hope that you and your listeners will enjoy this wonderful, pure Michigan day. Actually, it's wonderful out there. Thank you very much.
Now this fun note, it was 1 year ago this day that Stateside first began, and what a year it has been. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you, too, for connecting with us. As always, you can find us online at michiganradio.org. Just click on the link that says Stateside. You can connect with us on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And we are on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Let us know what stories and what conversations you want to hear. And happy 1 year anniversary to us. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. There are fewer immigrants choosing to make Michigan their new home. Figures released by the Department of Homeland Security track the number of persons who got their green cards, the cards that give them permanent resident status, and it tracks where they're living. Michigan saw a 4.6% decrease in immigrants in 2012. That's down to the second lowest level in the last 12 years. But there is one immigrant group choosing to make Michigan their new home, Iraqis. They're flowing into Michigan. And joining us now to help explain why and what this means for our state is Kurt Metzger of Data Driven Detroit. Welcome back to Stateside, Kurt.
Thanks so much, Cynthia. Good to be here.
Are you surprised overall that fewer people are immigrating to Michigan?
I was surprised. I mean, we've really started to intensify our efforts at welcoming immigrants. I know that the governor has been very active, and obviously he's even heading to China with the travel folks, trying to get more people to come. And I know that with the Welcoming Michigan program and a lot of the efforts that have been undertaken, it's somewhat surprising that they're not taking hold quite yet. So, I mean, it's always interesting to see the numbers and then start to determine how best to reorient the program or understand what's going on.
And this really matters to especially Michigan cities, isn't it, as far as is having immigrants in Michigan. Talk to us about those benefits.
Well, it's very important. I think in many ways it's important for immigrants for no other reason than we've talked previously on the show about decreasing birth rates, decreasing numbers of people choosing Michigan, although we've started to see some turnaround in that. But Michigan needs people. Michigan needs younger people. Michigan needs people who are in their childbearing years, and so we need to try to generate those numbers. And the cities, obviously, we find that immigrants are very entrepreneurial, so in many cities have seen a lot of job creation, company creation. A lot of that is technology, but you also have immigrants who start the grocery stores, the restaurants, the small retail and service businesses, and so they generate economic impact in communities, and they also redevelop communities by moving into some of the neighborhoods that have seen disinvestment, and immigrants have been found to find those areas very optimal for them because it's low amount of money to get in, and they really put the money into redeveloping and improving those neighborhoods.
So let's talk about this trend of Iraqi immigrants flowing into Michigan. What's behind that, and to what extent are they coming in?
Well, actually, the Iraqis, it's funny. When you look at the numbers, Iraq is producing quite a few, both the standard immigration, but you're also seeing large numbers of refugees coming in as well. We can't track the refugees exactly to geography, but we can track the immigrants, and we're finding that Iraq is one of the top countries, and Michigan is just second to California in terms of its attraction of Iraqi immigrants. They've found the area to be very beneficial. They've established themselves in this area, and it's both Muslim and Christian Iraqis, but primarily what we call the Chaldean community that has established itself in metropolitan Detroit. In fact, when you look at the numbers, 92% of all Iraqi immigrants come to metropolitan Detroit. And we've done some studies with the Chaldean Chamber of Commerce and the Chaldean Federation, and we've come up with estimates of about 100,000 to 120,000. And interestingly enough, about 60% of those own businesses, which is an incredible a number. It's a tremendous economic impact to the area. And they've obviously found this state and this region to be very attractive and have continued to increase their numbers.
And as far as assimilation into the community, are they doing that? Are they assimilating and becoming a part of Michigan's communities?
I believe so. I mean, it's always interesting how we interpret assimilation. I mean, the Iraqi community tends to be fairly concentrated in certain areas. So in metropolitan Detroit, large numbers in West Bloomfield and Shelby Township over in Macomb County, Sterling Heights, they tend to concentrate around their churches. And what they've done is obviously not only have they been very strong in the areas of corner stores, as we talk about the specialty stores, a lot of the grocery stores, but more recent, the children, the second and third generation, a lot of these families are really pushing. They're becoming the professionals, the doctors, lawyers, a lot of information technology. They're getting into the whole cell phone business. So there's very, very broadly involved in a number of economic pursuits. And the community itself has developed so many services, really created a whole set of services for new immigrants. And that has been obviously very effective at attracting people.
Do we think, or is there any way of predicting where the trend might go in the years to come in terms of immigrants coming from Iraq? What I'm thinking of is as we see the wind down of the war and the military action in Iraq, do you think that will impact how many people choose to immigrate?
It's probably, yes. I mean, I think things might be settling somewhat, although recent reports of the bombings, it doesn't show that its stability is necessarily there. I think the Christian community, the Iraqi Christians, still are the small minority, and I don't think that they are necessarily see themselves as welcome in the country and are still looking to move out. I would think that those numbers will continue to increase. I think that just because the community is so well established in the United States and has become very successful, I think that there's probably more likelihood of at least the Christian Iraqis, those that are left, continuing to come. We're starting to see more now Syria. We're starting to see more Syrian refugees headed over. And we also hear that they're very close in many ways to the Iraqis. And so Southeast Michigan, the metropolitan area, is starting to be an attractive area for that group as well.
Kurt Metzger of Data Driven Detroit, as always, keeping an eye on our population trends and crunching those numbers for us. Kurt, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Everybody's got a story. Some are very extraordinary stories. It might be good for somebody to look into theirs.
Because a story is the shortest distance between two people.
The Living Room is our ongoing storytelling series hosted by Allison Downey.
Today on The Living Room, back to school. Like many Michiganders, I returned to school this week. I've been a university professor for over a decade, so I've had a lot of first days. But for my son Michael, Tuesday was different. It was his first day of kindergarten. And probably because I teach future elementary teachers and because I'm a mom, I've been really curious about kids' perceptions of school. And so last June, I visited Michael's preschool, Learning Village in Kalamazoo, and I asked some of his classmates what they were excited about.
Going to kindergarten. I already stopped sucking my thumb in.
Don't poop at kindergarten. Not in your pants, not in your diaper.
How long do you think you're going to go to school for?
A week.
130 weeks.
What do you think you're going to learn in school?
To not be mean and to not push and hit and kick.
How to make new friends that we never ever met before.
I wanted to get the real scoop from the experts. Students from Dawn Hostler's kindergarten class at Woods Lake Elementary, a magnet center for the arts in Kalamazoo. How do you feel at the start of school?
Scared, because it's a new school and you really don't know.
At the start of school,
You'll talk to teachers and they have nightmares. We are just as nervous as the kids are.
And now that you've been here for a year, how do you feel?
Happy.
I wondered, what insights might a child have at the end of 6 years of elementary school? What advice do you have for someone who's just coming into elementary school?
To listen to your teachers and do not play in toilet water.
Don't play around because the teachers don't play.
But they're going to be happy there and that they're going to learn new things, just like us.
Stay in school, don't be a fool.
Welcome to school.
Welcome to school.
Welcome to school.
Welcome to school.
Now let's head over to Detroit, where a new experiment in community education is just getting underway. What if something other than jobs could rebuild Detroit? What if the purpose of education was to help children reach their highest human potential? What if we had a conversation about the meaning of service to our community? These are just a few of the many questions being raised at a new charter school in Detroit. It's called the James and Grace Lee Boggs School, and they opened their doors this week. Living Room producer Zach Rosen brings us this report.
The to-do list for opening a new school is huge. You've got to find a building and fix it up.
We're going to strip and wax the floor.
You've got to hire teachers, write a curriculum, figure out a mission. And then there's all this other stuff you'd never think of, like laying down new wood chips by the jungle gym.
To distribute the pile.
And then, of course, you have to find parents who want to send their kids to your school.
Hello, how are you guys? You guys live over here?
Yeah, I live downstairs.
You want a brochure? We're opening up a school.
The canvasser you're hearing is Shekinah Hockenhall, a summer intern at the Boggs School.
I'm right here, Mitchell.
All right. That's us. You know what? Maybe we'll play this game outside. Would that be fun? I would like to do that.
The Boggs School started this week with kids in kindergarten through fourth grade, with a plan to roll out a new class every year. So by 2026, they'll be K through 12.
My name is Julia Putnam. I'm one of the founders of the Boggs School and the principal.
Julia grew up in Detroit and graduated from a Detroit public high school. She went on to teach for 5 years at a charter school, but after a while became disillusioned.
The writing on the wall was like, oh, this is not a place where my voice is valued. This is not a place where I'm going to have any say in what happens. The leadership skills that I do have are of no interest.
So about 5 years ago, Julia and a group of teachers and parents and community organizers started to think about opening their own school. And not just any school, but a place that would creatively address the current circumstance Detroit finds itself in.
We've been growing our economy, and this is where it's gotten us. These vacant lots, these, you know, abandoned houses. That's what growing the economy has done, because it's like, oh, well, industry's not working here and I can make more money someplace else, so I ship it out and all the jobs are gone, and so people can't afford these houses and so they leave them. That's what growing the economy has gotten Detroit. And so what happens if we grow our souls here? What would it look like then? I want to prepare kids to ask those questions, because that's what's going to create the future, asking those questions, not thinking that we have the answer and then telling kids what they should be doing.
The school is named after James and Grace Lee Boggs, longtime Detroit community activists and writers whose house is just a few miles east of the new school.
James died in 1993, and Grace Lee Boggs is 98, still living, still writing, still publishing, and they both believed that the purpose of learning and the purpose of education was to build community, and that the way to engage young people was to have them actively involved in their education and in transforming the community while transforming themselves.
And how did you meet Grace and Jimmy?
They had started a program called Detroit Summer in 1992. They had come to my high school to recruit for the program. I was at Renaissance High School, very unhappy, learning really well how to get A's, but not so much why Detroit was the way it was, why it looked the way it looked, why abandoned buildings weren't being fixed, why people talked about Detroit in the past tense and felt so hopeless about its future. And when I heard or read about Grace and Jimmy and Detroit Summer and their idea that there was a crisis in Detroit, but in every social justice crisis, young people had made the difference, and they had hoped that young people would be interested in making a difference in Detroit by revitalizing it, re-spiriting it, and rebuilding it from the ground up. I became the very first young person to sign up for the program. and the ideals in Grace and Jimmy have made sense to me since then.
The Bog School sits on a quiet residential street in a building that's over 100 years old. Just across from the school is a well-maintained white bungalow with a perfectly mowed lawn. And, as is the case with a lot of streets in Detroit, there are several vacant lots dotting the neighborhood, places where houses once stood. The idea of place is a big one for the founders of the Bog School. By that, I mean the neighborhood where the school sits is going to be a big part of the school.
As the kids get older, like, they're learning to advocate for trash pickup, for instance. They're learning how civics works in the city, like who makes what decisions and how you impact those decisions through your engagement.
It's called place-based education, and it's a model that's already being practiced in small pockets around the country.
I want a kid to like graduate from our school and be able to look around and be like, I've been in this neighborhood forever. I know exactly what businesses will work. I know exactly what the needs are in this community, and not just in this neighborhood, but in Detroit in general. Like, I want to, like, graduate the next mayors. I want to graduate, like, the next city council people. I want to graduate the next business owners of Detroit. I want to graduate the next president, and a president who really has some, like, real understanding of social capital.
You're a little nervous? I think that's pretty normal. I bet your classmates are, too. You want to show your parents where your room is? Do you remember?
My name is Amanda Rossman, and I will be the executive director of the school.
Rossman spent 11 years teaching in Detroit before helping found the Bog School.
I'm also a school parent. My son will be in fourth grade here. You know, normally as teachers, we'd put it through the filter of, would we do this with our own kids? Is this acceptable for our kids? But they're actually here. So everything that happens here, the filter of, you know, our own kids will be experiencing it is real.
I think as a parent, I trust my child here because they trust their children here.
That's Whitney Syfex Walker. She's the school's new office manager and also the mother of a fourth grader.
It says a lot when the people that you work with and the people that say they're passionate about something believe in it enough to educate their own children in the system that, you know, that they're asking you to put your child in.
When I was interviewing Walker, her daughter Zoe actually hobbled into the office with an injury from gym class.
Is the gravel in my skin?
It looks like a very, 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 very tiny minor scratch. Let me see here.
But it hurts. You know I tend to cry.
I know. Oh, you're so warm.
Yes, I am.
During this academic year, I'll be spending a lot of time at the Bog School. I'll be checking in with students, teachers, and parents to learn the struggles and triumphs of what could be a new paradigm for education in Detroit.
So, do you have homework?
You mean that we do at home?
Yes.
We're excited to hear more from Zach Rosen and the Bog School over the course of the next year. You've been listening to The Living Room. I'm Allison Downey. The Living Room is produced by Zach Rosen and Allison Downey. This week, the city of Detroit released the transcript of a deposition given by emergency manager Kevin Orr late last month as part of Detroit's bankruptcy proceedings. While being questioned about the value of the city's art collection and whether the artwork would be used to help solve Detroit's liquidity problem, Orr's answer was, and I quote, "No, there are no plans to use the art or any other asset in particular to liquidate it to relieve liquidity issues in the city. What I have said and continue to say, all options are on the table." What does that mean? Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes has been parsing what Kevin Orr said during this deposition, and he came up with another possible role the DIA artwork might play in the bankruptcy drama. Daniel joins us now, as he does every Thursday. So what did you hear or read as you went through that deposition transcript?
Well, I think what you see, Cynthia, is a lawyer trying to hedge his bets, if you will. Kevin Orr was also asked whether they would consider pledging the art as collateral to secure some financing that the city is trying to get, $350 million, to help them close this swap deal that they had originally negotiated right before the bankruptcy. And he said, yeah. And then the question is, was he saying yes to a truncated question, or was he saying yes, they were going to use the collateral? But he also says in the deposition, as you just read, that everything is on all options remain on the table. So I think privately the answer is we don't plan to do that, but that doesn't mean we won't do that. And those are two very different things. But I think this raises some very interesting questions. I happen to be persuaded, and I think a lot of other people are persuaded, that if they were to go and sell the art, that they'd get into all sorts of problems with the three-county millage, and the funding for the museum would collapse.
We saw that very clearly. Brooks Patterson and the folks in Oakland County made that crystal clear, didn't they?
Exactly. So, you know, would this be of a piece of the same kind of thing, or would this be an attempt to pledge collateral to get cash that the city could use in a short-term to medium-term basis and probably never have to touch the art because you use it as collateral? Now, we've seen this in the auto industry when Ford mortgaged its North American business, including the Blue Oval, in 2006 to raise $23 billion. I mean, it's a little different, obviously, with the government, but the principle, I think, is the same.
Hmm.
And but I think it really – and I talked to one lawyer who's involved in this whole thing who said, you know, would you as a lender – except as collateral, a piece of art that you're not sure the city could sell if they went bad on your debt. And I think that's probably a pretty fair point. I mean, there are other assets maybe that the city could pledge, real estate assets or things like that, that maybe are more easily turned into cash than a piece of art which would be turned into a major Donnybrook if, in fact, they got to the point where they had to liquidate it.
And it's interesting, as you point out, the fact lawyers for the creditors are not making a peep about the spirit of Detroit or the fist means
that the money is in the art museum.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's really that's, and we don't know exactly what those numbers are. The numbers are being thrown all over the place, and you get armchair estimates when media people call up experts who are not involved directly in the process, and they throw a number out there. But Christie's Auction House has been retained by the city and is evaluating about 3,500 pieces of a 66,000-piece collection and trying to determine what the value of it is. And it is a misnomer to suggest, I think, at least at this juncture, that all of the art is saleable. I think the assessment is that anything that was originally acquired with taxpayer money would fall into the category of potentially saleable. On the other hand, anything that was given to the museum by private donors, therefore that public money was not used to procure those pieces of art, would fall outside the purview of this.
And wouldn't the good stuff be that the pieces acquired in the 20s when the city had money to do exactly that, acquire good art?
Yeah, primarily most of the pieces that we're talking about were acquired between 1922 and 1931, according to Graham Beale, the longtime director. Hmm. And the whole process was stopped in about 1955 of using public money to acquire pieces of art. But there was a period when Detroit went on a real buying spree in the 20s under Valentiner, the famous curator that they had there, director of the museum. So, I mean, this is one piece, and everybody keeps talking about the art, but there are other pieces of public art, when I use the fist as an example, and the spirit of Detroit, and there are certainly other assets, but I think they're trying to get through this process without actually having to liquidate any of these assets, but we'll see how that works.
And tell us a little more about this possible debtor-in-possession, DIP loan, $350 million, and how would it work, and what would they use it for?
Well, debtor-in-possession financing is a pretty common term in Chapter 11 bankruptcy, and essentially what it means is the debtor, whoever files for the bankruptcy, which in the corporate case would be a company, they are the debtor, and as they go into bankruptcy, they usually arrange for a financial facility or a loan that helps them run the company while they're in bankruptcy. Now, what they would be doing, I think, in this case is they've put out an RFP, a request for proposal, for two of the lending community saying we want to borrow $350 million, $250 of which would be used to essentially settle this swaps deal that has been hanging over their head that they've already negotiated. And then the other $100 million remaining would be used for what they're calling quality of life improvements. Now, that could be anything from getting lights turned on to garbage collection to they don't really specify what it would be, but it would be probably for some kind of city services. And they then have to go out to the financial community and say, who's willing to lend us the money? The financial community is going to say, what are you going to put up to back this? If we're going to lend you this money and you are the city of Detroit with abysmal bond ratings, poor cash flow, people leaving, what's our security here? So that's the discussion they need to have, which is where the art comes into, potentially comes into the discussion. Right now it's not actively in the discussion, but it's a potential one, and it's a very high-profile thing. I know some people say, I'm tired of hearing about the DIA, but this is a very high-profile, national and internationally known institution in the city of Detroit, and as a result, people tend to, who are not from here, but who are just trying to do their jobs and look, find where the money is, they're focusing on the DIA, understandably.
And as you put it so aptly in your column, the folks that Kevin Orr calls the Huns on Wall Street, their favorite color is green.
That's right.
Daniel Howes, Detroit News business columnist, thanks for talking with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And as we've seen, even the merest hint that portions of the DIA collection are being appraised by experts from Christie's has led to impassioned pleas from all over Michigan to keep the artwork out of the bankruptcy proceedings. Among the voices raised in this statewide conversation is that of longtime Detroit journalist Bill McGraw. His recent piece in Deadline Detroit says it all. Six things about Detroit that are worse than the idea of selling its artwork. Bill McGraw joins us now. Welcome to the program, Bill.
Thanks very much for having me.
Bill, before we get into those things that you feel are worse than the idea of selling DIA artwork, give us your view overall about the Detroit Institute of Arts and its sizable collection. What do you think it means to the city and to Michigan?
Well, I think it means a great deal. It's obviously a tremendous collection of culture. It's a tremendous tourist attraction. I took a young guy, a friend of a friend, on a tour of Detroit a couple weeks ago, and we stopped so I could show him the Diego Rivera murals, and he was blown away, and he just wanted to sit there for, 30 minutes and drink it all in.
Take us now, if you will, through those ideas that you had, things about Detroit that are worse than the idea of selling its artwork, such as?
Well, the points I made in my story were, first of all, I acknowledged selling the artwork does not mean, for instance, the pensioners are going to be made whole. My main concern in my article was that the people who worked for the city of Detroit over the years, especially who worked in public safety and put their lives on the line every day when they went to work, they could come out of bankruptcy in really bad shape that's going to have horrible consequences for the rest of their lives. And I noted that there's been much less outcry about that situation than there has been about selling some of the art. No one says they're going to sell all the art of the DIA. And I know even selling a couple pieces could be catastrophic, the way the art world works and all that. But, I wasn't advocating selling the art, and I acknowledged it wasn't a 1 + 1 = 2, that if you sell some art, the pensioners would be made whole. But I think that people need to come first, and in this part of the discussion, people haven't come first, and taking people's pensions away, if anyone can imagine what it would be like to suddenly not have most of their 401k that they've been saving up for the last 25 years. The other things I mentioned were the things in Detroit that don't work, which are legendary now, police response, fire response, the level of crime, the lack of ability to demolish buildings in a timely way. I did kind of ask the question, if bankruptcy could fix those things, and it would mean selling some art, do we want those things fixed? Do we want Detroit to be a city that works like most cities in America work? Or do we want to have a city that's still desperately poor and dysfunctional, but we have a great art museum?
If you've just joined us, I'm speaking with journalist Bill McGraw, whose piece in Deadline Detroit is entitled Six Things About Detroit That Are Worse Than the Idea of Selling Its Artwork. For instance, your number three is dying when a roof collapses on you while you're fighting a fire, and because your emergency alert is broken, your fellow firefighters can't find you. And this, of course, did happen.
That did happen about, I think it was 2010, to Walt Harris, who I knew. A firefighter from an East Side fire company, and they were in an abandoned house, and the roof collapsed, and the firefighters couldn't find him. Now, no one's saying he wasn't going to die anyways because of the tragic situation he was found in, or he found himself in. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, the fire department can't repair its equipment, and firefighters who are the busiest in the country are working with trucks that don't work and equipment that doesn't work, and that's one of the many, many aspects of the dysfunction of Detroit that, again, is bankruptcy supposed to fix those things? Bankruptcy is supposed to wipe the books clean of Detroit's debt. and give Detroit a fresh start. But those are the types of things that don't work in Detroit like they work in Chicago and New York and Indianapolis.
Why is it, do you think, Bill, that so many people are up in arms about the prospect of selling a Matisse or a Van Gogh, but when it comes to the streetlights, and as you point out, crying over your dead 12-year-old after she's hit by a car on Schaefer when the streetlights are out, why is that not getting as much agitation?
Well, I think, you know, the DIA is obviously, it's a huge symbol. It's literally this beautiful building that sits, you know, on Woodward Avenue that it's a, like we said earlier, it's a, both an attraction for cultural reasons and for tourist reasons. The daily lives of people in Detroit, just like the daily lives and people, say, in Cleveland or anywhere else, if you're not right there, it's not part of your, I guess, your daily consciousness. And I don't think it's because of any ill will on people elsewhere in Michigan, people who live in cities where when you call the police, they come right away. People forget what it would be like to live in a city where that isn't taken for granted. And daily life in Detroit, which happens for 700,000 people, plus all the visitors and the people who work in Detroit, those things sort of get, in a way, kind of left by the wayside in this debate.
Bill, what kind of conversations do you hope that your piece in Deadline Detroit might trigger?
Well, I hope for one thing that it triggers the importance of making sure the retirees are kept whole. They're not the banks. The banks are going to be in the insurance company that insure the money of the bondholders and all this. Those people got into selling Detroit bonds knowing full well Detroit was in bad shape financially. The pensioners are totally innocent victims who worked for the city for however many years. Part of the deal was, we'll work for you. If we are a firefighter or an EMS or a cop, we'll put our lives in the line every day, and we have a decent but certainly not elaborate pension waiting for us when we retire. And they're the ones that, for some reason, whether it's federal help or state help, should be kept whole. And as we know, the state constitution makes it very clear that though that pensions are not to be tampered with. So it's going to be very interesting what the federal bankruptcy judge decides, you know, how that's going to be handled and whether the state is going to have to pick up the money for these retirees. So that's really the main point of my discussion, sort of let's think of the pensioners.
Longtime Detroit journalist Bill McGraw, his piece, Six Things About Detroit That Are Worse Than the Idea of Selling Its Artwork, can be found at deadlinedetroit.com. Bill, thanks so much.
Thanks very much for having me.
Flashback to 1929. Most people would probably think Great Depression, but that's not the story we have today. In 1929, Paul and May Lewis founded the Lewis Brothers Circus. This traveling circus was based in Jackson, Michigan, and traveled all throughout the state. They even went to Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio, dazzling small towns with exotic creatures and acrobats. I sat down with Grace Wolbrink. She's a professional storyteller who collected memories from the family.
The circus was a world that was different. They had animals, you know, that came from other countries that nobody could see. And so life was around the small towns, but the circus helped them cross into another world and dimension that way.
Paul and May's nieces, Barbara and Nonna Stanton, toured with the circus during the summer as young girls. Barbara's stories helped create a museum exhibit about the Lewis Brothers Circus. That exhibit runs through September 7th at the Ella Sharp Museum in Jackson.
So their Aunt May would dress them up in makeup and fancy kind of Middle Eastern or Arabian costumes, and they would climb up on top of the elephant and ride the elephant in the spectacle, the parade that went around the circus tent to start off the big show.
That's the spec.
That's the spec. And all the performers showed off in that, and they got to do the funny car and the camel and the...
As little girls.
As little girls. And they had the sideshows, and they had the animals, they had the big cats, they had Two-Ton Tony and Jumbaloo for the elephants, and Willie the bear that, you know, escaped at one point before he officially joined the circus.
The circus ran from 1929 to 1945. During that time, Paul and May Lewis encountered a variety of obstacles that we just wouldn't think about today. The advance man who booked the next show in neighboring towns had to paint telephone poles with white and blue paint. Those markers served as directions for performers because many of them just couldn't read the road signs.
They would get to the next town. Paul would come out. He'd look around an empty lot or maybe a farmer's field. Then he would turn this dustbin into a magnificent show, and they'd put up the big top and set everybody up.
In the 1930s and 40s, people couldn't escape to the worlds of big screen TVs or iPhones. The circus was really the most exciting entertainment available for everyone, right?
They bought like a one-ring circus, and they rapidly, very successfully built it into a three-ring circus. And this was during the time of the Depression and World War II. Just an amazing kind of story of hope and endurance. And I can't imagine how this circus touched people's lives going through such uncertainty and trauma.
That's Grace Wolbrink sharing the story of a circus from Jackson, Michigan. You can visit the exhibit until September 7th at the Ella Sharp Museum of Art and History in Jackson. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Scon. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Mercedes Mejia, and Katie Suha. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk Monday afternoon at 3 o'clock.